so hard.
Okay, well, this is episode 40 of The Job. It is late May, and it's starting to get really nice out here in Portland.
Sure is.
I'm here with Candace. Hi, Candace.
Hi, Ray.
I just realized this week, in my gratitude for the amazing La Marzocco GS3 that we have in here. Honestly, every day I come in, I'm super psyched and grateful to have that thing. But I was just realizing that the majority of our team, which is currently five, have worked as baristas. Mm-hmm. Technically, 4 out of 5.
Am I the one that hasn't? Are you?
No. The one that hasn't would be Corey.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Corey has no coffee experience.
He's more of a beer guy.
Yeah, he's more of a beer guy. He actually runs the site Taplister, I think. No, wait, that's not him. I'm thinking of someone else. He runs some beer site. I don't currently know the URL.
Glad to know you're paying attention.
Oh, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, very busy.
My coffee experience is pretty minimal, coffee serving experience, but thank you for technically adding me in there.
I bumped us up a number there, yeah. I was also going to mention that I did post an iced espresso drink recipe up last week, so.
It's so good.
It's really good.
It really is.
I think maybe we did mention it, and because I feel like I joked that anyone can make it, you just need an espresso machine.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is kind of mean. You also need, for those who don't, you know.
Okay.
You also need those big ice cubes.
Yeah, which, you know. Just get a big ice cube.
Just get a big ice cube mold, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm still enjoying those espressos. I could sure use one right now.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, we're on the air. We also pitched a custom web font to a client yesterday and realized that will be maybe the third site that we've done that on. We're kind of becoming known for that.
Or we will when these sites start launching.
When any of them launches, yeah.
None
of them
are launched yet. We're becoming known in our minds. It's like the thing we do that nobody's seen.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is a really fun part of the process. Like, do you remember when we used to do flash sites?
Of course.
And we would make sites for artists, and we would sometimes have them sign their name, and then would sort of like write their name out, their signature out as like part of the site drawing in, and I felt like that was such a nice touch, and to be able to create a custom font from, you know, having someone help us that usually like writes on the boards or, you know, writes on the packaging, you know, something that's like, to be able to make that font and then have it be updatable, you know, on updatable text, I think is just really fun. That's a nice touch. Nice personal touch.
It totally does. Every time we bring the idea up, people are like, you can do that? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's such a... It's like...
It's some work, though. I mean,
Of course it is, yes. But, you know, I was thinking a lot about how... after our conversation yesterday about how a lot of designers even will freely admit that the web is like 95% typography. Mm-hmm. And if you really... If people walk into your coffee house or your restaurant or your shop, whatever, and they're used to seeing a certain handwriting, which is pretty common because people have a chalkboard up with prices and stuff, and often it's the same person who does that every day or week or whatever. Or even on menus, sometimes people handwrite those things. It's like, why not bring that into your website? I mean, you can't have someone redesign your website or redraw those every day, and you don't just want to put photos of a chalkboard. Mm-hmm. Although we have tried that. What you really want is to have that font that you're known for brought to the web and print. I mean, it's a font. You can use it anywhere. But, I mean, talk about... I mean, if your site is 95% copy and the typography and stuff, if it's your own font, wow, that's pretty cool. I don't know. It's pretty cool branding.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're talking to Cody Goldberg today of Harper's Playground. Let's hear from Cody. Hi, Cody. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for taking the time to come down to Needmore. Appreciate it. So why don't we just start by telling me, like, are you from Portland? Is this your hometown?
I am one of the many transplants from Northern California.
Okay, sure.
But I believe I've qualified for my Oregon green card now that I've been here for almost 20 years.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Okay. So before we talk about your current project, just give me a little background on what you did before this, where you're coming from.
You know, I've stumbled into a 15-year career, and I like to use, if I can do air quotes on the air here, air quotes around career in brand marketing.
Okay.
Certainly was accidental and never was the plan. I took a job in the mailroom at Adidas America back in 1999, and that was by the sheer necessity of needing a job.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely gravitated towards sports marketing because that seemed like the least amount of work and the most amount of fun. And then when I was recruited for a job in brand marketing with Red Bull Energy Drink a few years later, I definitely found an affinity for the storytelling that is brand marketing. And again, not being the sharpest tool in the shed, it seemed pretty straightforward. I understood what brand marketing was about. And so, yeah, I had about a 15-year career in brand marketing, and that led kind of perfectly into my new passion project, which is Harper's Playground, which I really launched as a brand, being that that's all I understood, essentially from the standpoint of creating awareness, and that's all I understood from a standpoint of getting people to help you if you have something to get done,
right?
Be it to sell a product or to sell an idea. And it turned into a $1.2 million special playground here in Portland, Oregon that took off to the extent that now it's my full-time job.
Okay. How did you decide to, when the right time was to do that full-time?
Well, who knows if it was right yet. I'm in the middle of it now. I think, but I spent about a full year concentrating on creating the groundwork to make the leap.
Okay.
And because we're a nonprofit, the primary focus of that time was spent on building a expanded and more professional board of directors than what we started with. And that's meant to be no slight on our original board. But those were neighbors we conned into coming to our house under the auspices of drinking beer and eating pizza with us. But then we sort of told them, well, you're also our board of directors now. And they performed admirably. But this is not just a more professional board, but it's definitely expanded.
Mm-hmm.
And having a board of directors to support your work is the groundwork that you really need to put in place. That and the strategic plan. And we really spent a lot of the last year building the strategic plan that is a sustainable model to take this forward.
To build other playgrounds and so forth?
Correct.
So I'm actually curious, before we go on, why is a board of directors so important to that type of work?
Well, that's a perfect question. It's twofold. First and foremost, to be legitimate, you must have a board of directors.
Okay.
There is the oversight that a board offers you, and then there's also the work. And when you start out a nonprofit and you have no paid staff, the board does the work.
Okay.
And there's a lot of work to be done. Everything from the actual programming and strategic planning to the fundraising and development planning to the oversight of the organization, which is doing an insurance package. And as you can tell, as the brand marketing guy, I don't even like to talk about that stuff.
Right.
But it's all there. There's all that paperwork.
So the board is pretty involved in what you're doing, it sounds like. They're not just...
Very much so.
Yeah, okay.
Very much so. And I think it's a very standard way forward for starting nonprofits.
Mm-hmm.
You start with a working board. The board is heavily involved in doing the work. And as you grow and you're able to hire more staff, the board can pull back and spend more of its energies on the strategic plan and the oversight part of things.
So just so that our listeners can get up to speed, why don't you tell me the story of your journey and how Harper's Playground came to be.
Harper's Playground, I think, like a lot of nonprofits, started from a very simple necessity being seen that was not being met, I guess. Our daughter, Harper, uses a walker to get around, and we noticed that when she made it in her walker to our neighborhood park. There was nothing for her to do there. And a little research online discovered that there were such things as accessible playgrounds. And we thought, well, why shouldn't our playground be accessible for our daughter? So we approached our neighborhood parks and rec department, asked them to build one. And they said, there's no money in the budget for such a thing. But if you'd like to go out and raise the money yourselves, we will allow you to do so. And that is the that's the genesis. So we started with a bake sale in front of our house. And like I mentioned earlier, being in brand marketing, I got to the business of creating a logo and a website and all the other accoutrements of brand marketing, a flyer and all the rest, and just got busy. And it was one of those things where the concept is so logical. Play is so important for children, and children who experience disability need it even more so to help them catch up and to develop and to make the social connections that a playground offers. So it was always an easy sell. Playgrounds should be accessible for all. Mm-hmm. And it being that it kind of enveloped my whole being to a level that's hard to describe, I just brought it up in every conversation for a few years, and I reached out to everyone I've ever met and asked them to help. And it sort of took off from there.
So in terms of time, how long was this from when you had this realization, this epiphany, to when you, you know, broke ground on it?
It was from first idea until the ribbon cutting, it was 3 years.
Okay.
And so we're approaching 4 years now since we started the idea. And that's a pretty fast timeline, actually, since the total amount we raised was $1.2 million between cash and in-kind services. But, you know, we've been at it 4 years in terms of focused energy, and feels like we're at the right place to be launching it to go bigger.
Was it hard doing this while, like, having a full-time job, like, pulling this together?
Definitely was. Time management was a key focus of my energies, and marrying a woman who's extremely forgiving was a key part of our success. She allowed me to really put a lot of time into this, and it was pretty much every weekend, every lunch hour, and many evenings spent. You know, it's a lot of meetings, a lot of coordinating meetings, especially large fundraising events that we grew from doing the very simple bake sale in front of our house to the large gala. And those large galas where it's a seated meal and auction items and all that business, it's a ton of coordinating, ton of meetings. So yeah, to answer your question though, it was challenging to balance having a job and having another job.
Is this type of playground? I've got to admit, it seems like a great idea and a necessity and an obvious thing, really, to say that all kids should be able to play in a playground. Is it something that exists elsewhere outside of Portland? Is there anything that comes close in Portland in the past?
So there are, in just the Portland Metro, Portland Parks and Recs District, there's Portland Metros beyond that, but in Portland, the city of Portland has 110 playgrounds, and this is the only one that's universally accessible, 100%. The one that's closest was built about 16 years ago. It was fully funded by the Rotary of Portland, and Portland Parks and Rec estimates that they can call it 70% accessible. Okay. So there's definitely a big need to change that model, for sure. Around the country, there are some other examples of things that are somewhat similar. I think what we really embraced and what sets Harper's Playground apart from almost all of the rest is that we 100% went away from any sort of structure on site. It's completely a play plaza. And that's really because we found that no matter how you try to adapt the structure with some sort of ramp system, it still segregates people who use wheels and forces them to a different route. And so we eliminate the structure altogether and create this play plaza. And that design concept was really pioneered by an outfit called MIG out of Berkeley, California. It has existed before that in terms of artists who have created parks in the past. Mm-hmm. You know, the 60s and 70s saw some really beautiful playgrounds around the world that I think it was actually almost by happenstance that some of them were universally accessible. That's just because they were the vision of an artist who put them together. And the entire playground industry in the late 70s, early 80s started really moving towards these pre-manufactured structures that are not only inaccessible, but are uninspiring. And really, kids have shown they don't really like them that much.
Yeah, I very much agree with you. I think probably you wrote the copy on the website that points out that some of the accessible playgrounds, if I can quote you here, look about as fun as a TSA line at the airport. Yep. I would agree with it. That video on your website is very inspirational and brought together a lot of very recognizable voices in Portland. How did you get that together, and how important do you think having that video to introduce people to what you're doing, how important do you think that is?
The video was produced by a local outfit called Actual Industries, and they embraced our project early on. They had done a project with the Timbers Army called Art Takeover, and it was a fundraiser that the Timbers Army and Actual Industries and another local outfit called Factory North all put together. And the video is pretty recent, actually. Actual Industries was kind enough to take a lot of the old footage that we had been collecting. They shot new interviews and put together that nice piece for us. And we had two main missions for that video. We wanted to use it as a thank you to everyone who helped us, so be able to share with all of these people who had put so much time and energy into the project to say, hey, thanks, and here's a cool video that celebrates you. But we also had a dual purpose for the video, and we did want it to help tell the story and attract more people to the whole concept. Mm-hmm. And so it's definitely been, I think, successful at doing both of those things. Having a background in film, it was fun to work with some professionals in that, for sure. I think I might have forgotten part of that question. I think I just, sometimes I get to talking and all over the shop.
No, we're going to go all over the place here. That's great. I found a lot of stuff that I enjoyed reading on your website. I also wanted to ask you about, there's a section on your site where you talk about the solution to this problem with mm-hmm. A playground use for everyone and access. And you quoted R. Buckminster Fuller. Are you a fan?
Huge.
Okay.
Huge fan.
Okay. How does his work inspire what you're doing?
Well, you know, I found out a lot about myself in this process. There's no doubt. Mm-hmm. And I think I found out that I love design, and I especially love the great designers. For the reason that I think is why a lot of us are attracted to them. They are usually cutting through the clutter of over-thoughtfulness and getting actually to the heart of things, which is simplicity. And I think our Buckminster Fuller, I also am a big fan of Frank Lloyd Wright. I find their design philosophy and what they accomplish to be simplification of things and really considering the user and their user experience all the way. So Buckminster Fuller, I just also love what he said, the one I really love probably most, he said, I never set out to create something beautiful, but if the solution I come up with isn't beautiful, then I know it's wrong. And I really like that. He's really speaking about the function is everything, but if it's not beautiful, you know that it's not right. And I just, I think if for a playground, that's especially important. You know, beauty, I talked about this recently in another talk about the science behind our reaction to beauty and how uplifting that is. And so I always knew the playground had to be beautiful. The overall aesthetic had to be beautiful. And that's in large part because it's going to bear, well, now it bears my daughter's name. Mm-hmm. And she's pretty beautiful.
So Where do you see, now that you're doing this full time, but you're in it now, what is your goal?
My very simple goal is to work myself out of a job and to have the Harper's Playground model literally become the new model of all playgrounds, such that I'm no longer necessary. I'm on a mission to change every playground in the world.
I like it.
Yeah.
Why not? Do you see being the next step? Are you thinking about another location in Portland, or do you have any plans you can talk about now for that?
Yeah. So really, it's twofold. We plan to engage as the lead agency in transforming some playground projects here in Portland, Oregon. Our vision is for 4 more in the city of Portland by the year 2020. And there's sort of a ready-made reason for that. Portland Parks and Recreation has what's called a Vision 2020 plan that they created about, I think, the middle of the 90s or maybe early 2000s. And we just want to dovetail into their plan and help them realize their vision. And also just, it sounds like a good, catchy title for a vision plan, and that's why they named it 2020, Clear Vision. Mm-hmm. So 4 more in Portland, because there are officially 5 quadrants in Portland. We built the first Harper's Playground in the 5th quadrant, North Portland, so each other quadrant we think should get one. And that's also a nice clear way to have an equal distribution of these, you know, vital amenities throughout the city, spread equally. Concurrently, we're working on a model where we act as a consulting group for other municipalities and help them realize a Harper's Playground with our support. And what's nice about that is we don't do all of the heavy lifting ourselves to raise the funds to do the project. We will come in and help others do it. And that should help us with not only being a sustainable model, but a more impactful model in a shorter time frame, I think. Like I said, I'm not the sharpest tool in the shed, but I just try to keep it simple.
If there was someone else who had a passion project in mind, like you, felt really strongly about wanting to change something that's just driving them crazy, that affects them personally, what is the key to doing something grassroots like this? You know, how do you need a marketing background? Do you need to know the city council members? Like, what is the secret there?
This is a great question. This is a fascinating one that I'll try to work my way through here in answering it. I think ultimately what you need is persistence, a dogged persistence to see your vision come to be. And in the earliest stages, you need to convince people, whether it's true or not, that you have that. I think it's the process of convincing people that you're not going to give up, that it's going to happen. Well, then they actually will start to join and help, and because they do believe you. I do remember in the earliest stages, I did believe it was going to happen, and I would tell people about that belief, and then they would start to help. And the next thing you knew, you had an army of people helping, and then it started to transform. So I think actually, yeah, it's... the answer is the stone soup model of how you accomplish anything. I think the book, The Stone Soup, the old story, is sort of how most everything gets done, in essence. Even if it's a project with a big budget and the money's already there, you still have to attract people to get involved and help. And they have to, before people will really give of themselves to something, they have to see that the vision is clear and it's going to happen, whether it's grassroots or building a dam that's, again, fully funded. The key player involved has to definitely see it through and see it's going to happen. There's a long-winded answer to just saying persistence. Ultimately.
Yeah. So how has this project changed you? How was Cody different 5 years ago from now?
Man, it's hard to remember the Cody then to a certain degree. I think he must have been a little bit lost. He just wasn't quite... I don't think I've ever spoken about myself in the third person like that. I wasn't sure exactly what my dream was in life. You know, I think something I've been looking for since I was a little kid, dream slash mission. What am I here to do? And I'm different now because I found it. This is definitely what I was put on this earth to do, was to build these playgrounds. And it took my daughter coming into my life to show that to me. I probably was never, it was never right before then, but it's right now. And all of my experiences before Harper coming into my life led to this place. And I think that's also why I was able to convince people it was going to happen. I knew in every cell of my body that this is what I should be doing. And that's why doing an all-nighter to fill out a grant application never felt tedious to me. It felt I was doing what I was supposed to be doing. It was leading us to the next stage, which was to complete this project that I believed in so wholeheartedly that, I mean, the cliches of when you find love that you, when you find love, when you find work that you love, it's not work. I've changed because I found my special purpose. Just like Steve Martin in The Jerk.
I was going to say, yes. That's a quote from The Jerk.
Okay. Yep, yep.
On that note, Cody, thank you so much for coming down and talking to me today.
Awesome. My pleasure. I think we've ended on the perfect the perfect quote for this, for the show. Yeah, thanks for having me.
ThoughtBot is a consulting agency that does lots of great open source work, and I like them. But I recently stumbled across their version 2.0 of their playbook. Mm-hmm. They basically open sourced their employee handbook. The thing is kind of huge and so remarkably smart. Candid.
Yeah.
I mean, with you know, there are a lot of companies that sort of come to mind as I know about them and really respect them for the work that they do, like this, you know, like certainly GitHub does great open source contributions. You know, Zurb is known for that. We've used their foundation framework a lot. And ThoughtBot has great, you know, plugins. They make their own, you know, design frameworks. And the fact that they put their entire basically business playbook, I guess it is, online is, I mean, reading that thing is pretty eye-opening.
Yeah. I'm partly through. And I've been really impressed with how well thought out a lot of their policies are and how well they support both clients and the people working there. You know, and I think that's a...
It's hard. It's a hard balance to strike because... Mm-hmm. You want to make a living, a good living, hopefully, and pay your people well, and you want your people to be happy. But at the same time, like, the whole point of when you're, you know, doing work for clients, work for hire, you know, consulting, mm-hmm. you know, you actually are doing it for people who have a budget, are probably pretty conscious of their budget, and have their own goals that are different than yours, and their own sort of business case, and... It can be hard to strike a balance. You want both sides to be happy for you to be successful.
Yeah. What struck me, I think, most about their playbook and something that you and I have been talking a lot about is how to have a partnership after a site launches.
Yeah.
So I think there was a time when it maybe made more sense, especially when we were doing flash sites in a way, where you would make a site and you would put it up and the site's there and it's up and like, there you go, there's your site, have a nice day.
They were simple and virtually unbreakable.
Right, and not much changed.
Right.
And so I think that model worked then, but now where we're using CMS that needs to be consistently updated and plugins.
E-commerce that needs to be maintained and security issues and... Sorry.
And not just like the kidding.
Goes on and on.
But not just that, but just the idea that after, you know, we're making bigger sites now, and after those sites go out into the world, that's when you really start learning about what's working and what isn't. And if you can spend time with that site over time, watching it be used, you can start to refine it and make it a stronger and stronger.
Make it much better.
Yes. Yeah. Then if you just put it out there and you're like, there we go, it's pretty, we're done. And I thought that their description of how they do that is smart, that they basically set aside, I mean, they're probably working on slightly bigger projects than ours, I would guess, but they set aside basically a week, a month for the projects that they're keeping up with and maintaining, and not only maintain them, but also push them farther and learn about them and, you know, work with clients on goals and what should we be doing next month. But it's a continuous chunk of time. And I think that, that's so smart, because there are so many times that something will come up and I'll think, that would be really great on this person's site, but now I need to, like, get a hold of them and pitch it to them, that, you know, and it consistently feels like I'm basically trying to, like, drum up a business for us, when really what I want to be doing is working hand in hand with someone to refine something over time and to be able to bring these ideas to the table and have it be a given that we're slowly working on it, kind of the way you would a home. You know, you don't move in and just done. You make a list, and over time you continuously, as you live in it, as you see where, like, the sun hits in the summer, that's when you might, like, paint something, or, you know, it's like, it to me, it's a similar experience to
us. It can be even a bigger scope than that. I mean, the your home is a good analogy, because you might realize when you move in, like, I don't want this to be a dining room. I want it to be a living room. That's a completely different purpose, you know? You might have to, move things from one floor
speaking
to another.
Speaking from experience.
Yeah, this is our house. But, you know, a lot of knowledge about a site, a huge amount, comes after it launches.
Yeah.
I mean, we know, like, a lot of times, I think what this playbook has taught me is, and one of the many things is that you should set that expectation from the start, that there should be a budget for what happens after the site launches and how you can, you know, make little or even big improvements to it or whatever, you know, like, I think, you know.
And how important it is to talk about that up front.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just have a plan for that. Like, I think it ends up, you know, I think the takeaway is that it should be a thing that feels good for both parties, both the client and the agency. Mm-hmm. Like, it should work for both parties, you know, like the way that we do it right now sometimes doesn't feel like it does. Then it's nobody's fault. Well, I guess it's our fault for not using this more like this model. So that will do.
Well, luckily, we're good at integrating new ideas and changing very quickly.
Agile in that business. So.
Yeah, and, you know, I so much appreciate that they would publish something like this, because I think that we all do better when everyone's doing good work. And, you know, like, this is really one of the first times I've read something where someone basically said, it's okay to say that after a website is launched, it still needs some love. You still need to get to know it. That's when you start. That's when you really start to live and breathe with it. And some things are going to change over time. And, hey, that's expected. So let's just talk about that and put it as part of the plan so that we're all excited and we're ready for it when it happens, instead of it starting to happen and it's like, oh, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Should we make changes? Is this part of the original scope? It's like, no, you know, let's just create a space for that. So, you know, I think that's really smart, and I totally agree that that's sort of how things go. And it just was really nice to see somebody write about it.
All right.
Okay.
Next week.
Iced espresso now. Yeah?
Sure.